The House and Senate will both return Monday and stay in session through Thursday. Last week in the House came back on Tuesday and took up and passed two bills under suspension of the rules. On Wednesday, the House took up a rule governing floor consideration of several bills, including H.R. 7688, the Reforming Intelligence and Securing America Act. To the surprise of the House Republican leadership, the rule failed again, when this time 19 Republicans voted against it. That meant Speaker Johnson could not move to consideration of what he thought was the compromise bill to reauthorize the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act's Section 702. So instead, the House took up and passed a bill under suspension of the rules. On Thursday, the House took up and passed a bill under suspension of the rules. On Friday, the House took up and passed a new rule governing floor consideration of several bills, including H.R. 7688, the Reforming Intelligence and Securing America Act. Then the House began considering amendments to H.R. 7688. The first amendment was defeated, and then four amendments were agreed to. Then the House voted on the bill as amended, and it passed by a vote of 273 to 147, with 126 Republicans voting in favor and 88 against, and 147 Democrats voting in favor and 59 against. And then they were done. This week in the House will return Monday with the first vote set for 6:30 p.m. At that time, the House is scheduled to consider 11 bills under suspension of the rules and one bill under a rule. H.R. 529, Extending Limits of U.S. Customs Waters Act. On Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday, the House will take up a series of bills under a rule. First up will be H.R.E.S. 1117, opposing efforts to place one-sided pressure on Israel regarding Gaza. Then the House will consider H.R. 4639, the Fourth Amendment is Not for Sale Act. Then the House will take up H.R.E.S. 1112, denouncing the Biden administration's immigration policies. Then the House will consider six bills meant to push back against the Biden administration's overreach on household appliances. They are H.R. 6192, the Hands Off Our Home Appliances Act, which prohibits the federal government from putting new energy conservation mandates on household appliances. H.R. 7673, the Liberty in Laundry Act, which prohibits the government from prescribing or enforcing energy conservation standards for clothes washers that are not cost-effective or technologically feasible. H.R. 7645, the Clothes Dryer Reliability Act, same thing for clothes dryers. H.R. 7637, the Refrigerator Freedom Act, same, but for refrigerators. H.R. 7626, the Affordable Air Conditioning Act, same but for air conditioning units. And H.R. 7700, the Stop Unaffordable Dishwasher Standards Act, which addresses the Republicans' claims of the overregulation of dishwashers. But wait, that was the House schedule for this week that existed as of Saturday morning. But then something happened Saturday afternoon and evening. Iran attacked Israel, sending hundreds of drones, ballistic missiles, and cruise missiles at Israel at the same time in an attempt to overwhelm Israel's air defenses. Consequently, House Majority Leader Steve Scalise sent out a notice to those of us who follow such things, explaining that the schedule for this week would shift so the House could consider various pieces of legislation designed to show our nation's support for Israel. On Sunday, the schedule was updated. When the House returns today, the first vote will still be set for 6:30 p.m., but this time the House will consider five bills under suspension of the rules. Each of them deals with Iran in one form or another. They are H.R. 5921, the No U.S. Financing for Iran Act of 2023, H.R. 5923, the Iran-China Energy Sanctions Act of 2023, H.R. 6245, the Holding Iranian Leaders Accountable Act of 2023. H.R. 6015, the Iran Sanctions Accountability Act of 2023. And H.R. 6408, to amend the Internal Revenue Code of 1986 to terminate the tax-exempt status of terrorist-supporting organizations as amended. Then, on Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday, the House will consider the following under suspension of the rules. H.R. 3033, the Solidify Iran Sanctions Act. H.R. 6603, the No Technology for Terror Act. H.R. 5917, the Strengthening Tools to Counter the Use of Human Shields Act. H.R. 5826, the No Paydays for Hostage Takers Act. H.R. 4681, the Illicit Captagon Trafficking Suppression Act. H.Res. 288, encouraging the EU to designate resolution. H.Res. 883, expressing the sense of the House of Representatives that the slogan, "From the river to the sea, Palestine will be free," is anti-Semitic and its use must be condemned. In addition, the House will consider the following legislation pursuant to a rule. H.Res. unnumbered as yet, condemning Iran's unprecedented drone and missile attack on Israel. H.R. 6046, the Standing Against Houthi Aggression Act. H.R. 6323, the Iran Counterterrorism Act. H.R. 4691, the Iran Sanctions Review Act. H.R. 5947, to provide for the rescission of certain waivers and licenses relating to Iran and for other purposes. H.R. 4639, the Fourth Amendment is Not for Sale Act. Additional legislative items related to security supplemental appropriations are possible. But before we move to the rest of the week, let's go back to the very first thing the House will consider Monday evening upon its return. That is a motion to table, a motion to reconsider, offered by Congresswoman Anna Paulina Luna, Republican of Florida. A motion to reconsider is just what it sounds like. It's a motion that would take the action the House just took in passing a bill and reverse it. In this case, Congresswoman Luna has offered a motion to reconsider H.R. 7688, the Reforming Intelligence and Securing America Act. She was upset that the Biggs-Jayapal amendment regarding requiring a warrant for a U.S. person communications query was not agreed to. The leadership's position is that the bill has now passed. Consequently, it has responded to her motion to reconsider by offering a motion to table her resolution. So one of the first things that will happen is a vote to table her resolution. Let's put that in clear language. The vote to table is a vote to maintain the status quo, to support the bill as it passed. A vote to defeat the motion to table is a vote to move on to her vote to reconsider. That's what'll be on the floor of the House tonight. Last week in the Senate came back on Monday and voted to invoke cloture on the nomination of Susan M. Bazes to be a U.S. District Judge for the District of Nebraska. On Tuesday, the Senate voted to confirm her to that position. Then the Senate voted to invoke cloture on and then to confirm the nomination of Robert J. White to be a U.S. District Judge for the Eastern District of Michigan. Then the Senate voted to invoke cloture on the nomination of Anne Marie McKiff Allen to be a U.S. District Judge for the District of Utah. On Wednesday, the Senate voted to confirm her to that position. Then the Senate voted by 53-47 to pass S.J. Res. 61, a joint resolution providing for congressional disapproval under the Congressional Review Act of the rules submitted by the Federal Highway Administration relating to National Performance Management Measure, Assessing Performance of the National Highway System Greenhouse Gas Emissions Measure. Then, by a vote of 50-48, the Senate passed H.J. Res. 98, a joint resolution providing for congressional disapproval under the Congressional Review Act of the rules submitted by the National Labor Relations Board relating to Standard for Determining Joint Employer Status. On Thursday, the Senate agreed to a motion to proceed to executive session to consider calendar number 478, Ramona Villagomez Manglona. Then the Senate agreed to a motion to recess until Monday, April 15, and then they were done. This week in the Senate will return Monday with the first vote set for 5:30 p.m. At that time, the Senate will proceed to a roll call vote to invoke cloture on the nomination of Ramona Villagomez Manglona to be judge for the district court for the Northern Marianas Islands for a term of 10 years. On Tuesday, the House impeachment managers will walk across the Capitol to the Senate to present the two articles of impeachment to the Senate. On Wednesday at 1 p.m., the Senate will proceed to open the impeachment trial of Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas by swearing in each senator individually. Then, Majority Leader Schumer will offer either a motion to dismiss the charges outright or a motion to table the charges. Republicans will counter with a series of points of order. We'll talk more about this in a moment. And at some point during the week, if it survives Congresswoman Luna's motion to reconsider in the House, the Senate will consider H.R. 7688, the Reforming Intelligence and Securing America Act. That's the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act reauthorization bill that passed the House last week. Now let's talk about the Biden student loan payoff scam round three. Last year, the Supreme Court blocked the Biden administration's plans to, quote-unquote, forgive $430 billion in student loan debt. I say, quote-unquote, because the administration cannot really forgive such a debt. All it can do is move the debt from the people who currently hold the debt, that is, people who signed a contract with a creditor to borrow money for school and then pay it back later, and move it to people who did not sign such contracts, who did not take out loans, or maybe they took out loans and paid them back already. The Supreme Court rightly ruled that the Biden administration had no legal authority to do what it wanted to do. Consequently, the Supreme Court blocked the Biden administration's plan. The Biden administration's response was, if at first we don't succeed, we'll try again. So on Monday of last week, Joe Biden announced his plans to forgive $84 billion in student loan debt using different criteria to define who was eligible and what kind of debt could be, quote unquote, forgiven. I anticipate that this plan will be challenged in the courts as well, and I anticipate that the courts, including the Supreme Court, eventually will once again strike down the Biden administration's plan as an executive overreach. What we should draw from this entire episode is this: the Biden administration is lawless. It does not feel bound by precedent or text. It appears to believe the Constitution is not a collection of limitations on the authority of the government, but a group of suggestions. Stay tuned. Now, let's talk more about that FISA reauthorization. Almost 50 years ago, in the wake of the intelligence community scandals of the 1970s, the Congress enacted the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, FISA, to authorize U.S. government surveillance against agents of a hostile foreign power operating outside the United States. Inside the United States. This is traditional intelligence gathering, and no one raised any questions about what so-called rights the targets of the surveillance might have. They were agents of a foreign power, and the protections of the Fourth Amendment to the Constitution did not and still do not apply to them. Then, following the attacks of 9/11, the Congress enacted legislation to ensure that our intelligence communities had the tools they needed to conduct intelligence gathering efforts overseas to protect us. In 2007, they amended the 1978 law to establish Section 702 of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. Section 702 authorizes the intelligence community to conduct warrantless surveillance against foreigners overseas. Since its inception, Section 702 has needed to be reauthorized by the Congress on a regular basis. The last time Section 702 was reauthorized was 2018. It was reauthorized for a five-year period ending in 2023. Legislation passed last year in advance of the expiration of Section 702 authority extended its authorization to April 19, 2024. That's this coming Friday. FISA, you may recall, was abused by certain officials of the FBI and the DOJ during the Obama administration to illegally spy on Carter Page, a volunteer for the 2016 Trump campaign. Under false pretenses, which included lying to a Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court judge, the FBI applied for and received a warrant to surveil Page. And then the FBI continued to deceive FISC judges every 3 months for 2 years, to keep extending their authority to spy on him illegally. But here's the important part. It was not Section 702 that was abused by the FBI and DOJ to obtain those warrants against Page illegally. Section 702 had nothing at all to do with it. It was the original text of the 1978 law that was abused, and it had nothing to do with collecting foreign intelligence overseas. Fast forward to last week, Speaker Johnson's decision to put legislation reauthorizing Section 702 on the floor. He had to do it last week because he needed to pass it in time for the Senate to have time to consider and pass it before its authority expires this coming Friday. Remember, over the last several months, the House had tried and failed twice before to move the FISA reauthorization legislation. Both times, Speaker Johnson put it on the floor and then pulled it after concluding he did not have the votes to pass it. He didn't have the votes to pass it because he couldn't get Republicans to agree to reauthorize Section 702. Opponents of Section 702 demand that in the few instances in which an American citizen's communications are caught up in the surveillance of a targeted foreigner for foreign intelligence purposes, the intelligence agencies must seek and obtain a warrant before acquiring the database about the American. But we're not talking about gathering information on an American for purposes of a criminal investigation. If we were, the law already requires the FBI to get a warrant from a judge. What we're looking at is the communications of an American for purposes of gathering foreign intelligence, which is a whole different thing. And the communications database we're going to query is full of communications that were gathered under an appropriate legal process. It seems to me the concern over reauthorizing Section 702 is misplaced. Nevertheless, there is a significant slice of the House Republican Conference that does not appear to understand or care about the difference between foreign intelligence and domestic crimes, and does not want to reauthorize Section 702 without first adding a requirement that a warrant be obtained before acquiring the database for those American citizen communications. They demanded the opportunity to vote to add an amendment that would do just that during floor consideration, and the Rules Committee agreed to make such an amendment in order. But then former President Trump upset the apple cart when he posted to his account on Truth Social a message saying, quote, in all caps, "Kill FISA. It was illegally used against me and many others. They spied on my campaign." 3 exclamation points. In the context of a vote to reauthorize Section 702, the former president's message indicates he does not know what he is talking about. As I just said, a volunteer in his campaign was illegally surveilled by the FBI after certain officials at the FBI and the DOJ abused the provisions of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. It had nothing to do with Section 702, which was the provision of FISA that was up for reauthorization by congressional vote during floor consideration last week. But that's beside the point. When Trump talks, many members of the House Republican Conference don't just listen, they do what he wants. In this case, 19 Republicans crossed party lines to tank the rule governing floor consideration, including Congressman Chip Roy of Texas, who is himself a member of the Rules Committee. In a previous day, we would have called a member of the Rules Committee from the majority party voting against his own speaker's rule unthinkable. In today's Congress, we call that Tuesday. So the speaker had to go back to the drawing board. He couldn't let Section 702 authority expire, so he made a change to the reauthorization legislation. He changed the length of time that the bill would be reauthorized from 5 years and shrank it to 2 years. So it would come up again for reauthorization during Trump's second term, assuming Trump wins the election in November. That was enough to garner the support he needed, and the reauthorization bill was brought back to the floor early Friday afternoon. In a series of votes, 6 amendments were considered. 5 of them were agreed to, 1 was not. The 5 that were agreed to included an amendment offered by Chip Roy of Texas that would require the FBI to report to Congress on a quarterly basis the number of U.S. person inquiries that had been conducted. Another amendment offered by Mike Waltz of Florida and Dan Crenshaw of Texas would enable the use of Section 702 information to vet foreigners traveling to the United States. The one amendment that was not agreed to was an amendment offered by Arizona Republican Andy Biggs and Washington Democrat Pramila Jayapal. Their amendment would have prohibited warrantless searches of U.S. person communications in the FISA 702 database, with exceptions for imminent threats to life or bodily harm, consent searches, or known cybersecurity threat signatures. It failed on a vote of 212 to 212. Remember, unlike baseball, where the tie goes to the runner, in the House of Representatives, a tie vote is a vote that goes down to defeat. And this is the really important part, the 212th vote against the vote that made it a tie vote and thereby defeated the amendment, was cast by Speaker Johnson, who normally does not vote. The not voting thing is not a Mike Johnson thing, it's a Speaker of the House thing. The Speaker normally does not vote. But in this case, Speaker Johnson was determined to see that particular amendment defeated. And when he realized the opponents were going to be one vote short, he stepped up and cast his vote against the amendment. And boy, oh boy, did those who wanted that amendment to pass let him have it after the vote. Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene blasted him for casting the deciding vote, when in fact, every one of the other 211 members he joined could also be said to have cast the deciding vote. The bill will now go to the Senate for consideration there this week, assuming the motion to table Congresswoman Luna's motion to reconsider succeeds. Now let's talk about non-citizen voting. On Friday at Mar-a-Lago, Speaker Johnson and former President Trump spoke to the press about a new bill that both are supporting. It's called the SAVE Act, and it's about election integrity. SAVE is short for Safeguard American Voter Eligibility. And what the bill does is simple. It amends the National Voter Registration Act, the NVRA, to require states to obtain documentary proof of citizenship to register an individual to vote in an election for federal office. Liberals and the media, but I repeat myself, do not understand this. They've already mocked the legislation, saying it's already illegal to vote in a federal election if you're not a citizen, as if this legislation makes it illegal to vote in a federal election if you are not a citizen. It does not do that. Here's the problem. The National Voter Registration Act, also called the Motor Voter Law, has a one-page form that every state is supposed to use to register people to vote. And that one-page form has a line on it that says, I am a citizen of the United States, and then has a box next to it that you're supposed to check to indicate that you are, in fact, a U.S. citizen. And then at the bottom of the form, you sign your signature to attest under penalty of perjury that everything you just filled out on the form is true and accurate, and voila, you are now registered to vote. And because you checked a box that indicated you are a U.S. citizen, and then you signed your name under penalty of perjury that everything you filled out is true and accurate, you must be a U.S. citizen, right? Because no one would, who ever had bad intent, ever lied on a document, did they? Swearing that you are a citizen is not at all the same as proving that you are a U.S. citizen. Swearing that you are a citizen simply requires you to say something. It doesn't require you to provide any proof of any kind. So there's a glaring flaw in the current NVRA form. It does not protect election integrity against those who would do us harm. It does not protect us against non-citizens willing to lie, or perhaps even worse, against non-citizens who are told to fill out the form and just check the box that says, I'm a citizen of the United States, even though they're not, because there might be money in it for them or for somebody else who's getting paid to register new voters and knows the bureaucrats down at the DMV don't check all that closely. There's not a lot of crime in my neighborhood, but I still keep a lock on my door, and I keep that door locked because it's better to be safe than sorry, right? We've been talking about non-citizen voting for the last few months, not because there's been a rash of non-citizen voting. There hasn't been, to my knowledge. But because with roughly 10 million illegal immigrants coming across the border in the last 3 years, the kind of numbers we've never seen before, there could be a rash of non-citizen voting coming to a polling place near you if we're not careful. And this bill is simple, and it heads off the problem before it ever arises. It's not an overreach, and it's not a solution in search of a problem. It's an inoculation against something bad that could happen if we're not careful. Now let's talk about the emergency supplemental, that is aid to Ukraine and Israel. As of this writing, very early Monday morning, I'm still not sure what to say about the latest on the president's request for emergency supplemental spending for Ukraine and Israel. I know that the Senate has passed a measure appropriating a total of $95 billion for Ukraine, Israel, Taiwan, and humanitarian assistance in several places, including Gaza. I know that the House has passed a bill appropriating $14 billion for Israel, paid for by redirecting funds that were originally slated to be sent to the Internal Revenue Service. I know that the House tried but failed to pass a so-called clean Israel-only funding bill, that is, a bill that provides assistance to Israel but does not pay for it, which means we would just borrow the money and add the amount to the already gargantuan national debt. We talked last week about Speaker Johnson's determination to find a way to move a bill with funding for Ukraine through the House, despite one of his own party colleagues' warning that doing so would bring down on him the wrath of God or Trump or the House Republican Conference, or at least a motion to vacate the speakership. I think it's fair to say that Speaker Johnson is worried about losing his job. I think it's also fair to say he's told multiple people he wants to move aid to Ukraine through the House. In fact, he said so on television publicly yesterday. I know key committee chairmen in the House, that is, key members of the House Republican leadership, want him to move that Ukraine aid and expect him to move that Ukraine aid this week. But as of early Monday morning, we don't see anything looking like Ukraine aid or the emergency supplemental on the schedule for this week. So we're stuck where we've been for the last 6 months, wondering if and when Ukraine and Israel will get more assistance from the United States. Now, let's talk about anti-Trump lawfare. Today, former President Trump makes history. He is the first former president of the United States to stand trial on criminal charges. In a courthouse in Manhattan, his trial on 34 counts of falsifying accounting records began with jury selection. The trial is expected to last 6 to 8 weeks. The key witness for the prosecution is Michael Cohen, who worked for Trump for years as his fixer. In a different court case a few weeks ago, the judge noted that Cohen had changed his story on something, and that meant that Cohen had lied. Either he had lied in the beginning, or he had lied when he changed his story. It will be interesting to see how credible the jury finds Michael Cohen. Trump, of course, sees this case as nothing more than election interference. I agree with him. This case never should have been brought in the first place. Now, on the other side of the country, let's talk about the Biden indictments. You almost have to feel sorry for Hunter Biden. He's got a lawyer working for him now who apparently has convinced him she should at least try to get the multiple charges against him thrown out before the criminal trials begin. So twice now in the last month, Biden has allowed his lawyer to file paperwork with the two courts where he'll be tried for tax felonies and gun charges. A few weeks ago, the judge in the tax case denied 8 different motions filed by Hunter's lawyer, and he was rather dismissive when he did so. On Friday, on the other side of the country, the judge in the gun charges case did the same thing, denying the motion to dismiss the case against him for what he claimed was selective prosecution. Hunter's lawyer tried to make the argument that he had been prosecuted only because he was a Biden, and the prosecution was purely political. U.S. District Judge Mary Ellen Noriega wrote, "Thus, defendants' articulated protected class is apparently family members of politically important persons. Defendant's claim is effectively that his own father targeted him for being his son, a claim that is nonsensical under the facts here. Regardless of whether congressional Republicans attempted to influence the executive branch, there is not evidence that they were successful." So the executive branch prosecuting defendant was at all relevant times and still is headed by defendant's father. Heck of a Justice Department. Hunter's lawyer's strategy doesn't seem to be working so well. And now, finally, to the Jenny Beth Show. Episode 61 of the Jenny Beth Show dropped last Wednesday. This time it features Jenny Beth's conversation with 3 of her favorites: former Congresswoman Michelle Bachmann of Minnesota, former Congressman Steve King of Iowa, and former Congressman Louis Gohmert of Texas. All 3 were members of Congress when the Tea Party was first formed, and all 3 provided invaluable assistance to Jenny Beth as she was learning her way around national politics in the nation's capital. It's a great conversation, and as always, is highly recommended. And that's our Washington Report for this week.